thank you all. It's really a privilege and honor to be here. I put some thought into how to do what I want to do today, and I realized that I'm just going to have to, I had to write it out because I wanted to get it right. So I'm going to try reading this. Dogen said, an ancient Buddha said, you all know this, the painting of a rice cake does not satisfy hunger. This statement has been studied by ancient Buddhas and present Buddhas. Nevertheless, it has become the mere chatter of seekers in grass-roofed huts and under trees. When they transmit their teaching, they say that this statement means that studying the sutras and commentaries does not nourish true wisdom. Or they suppose that it means that the study of sutras and of the three vehicles, or the one vehicle, is not the way of perfect enlightenment. Birth and death, coming and going, are paintings without exception. Supreme enlightenment is nothing but a painting. In the phenomenal world and the empty sky, there is nothing that is not a painting. If you say that a painting is not real, all things are not real. If all things are not real, the Dharma is not real either. If the Dharma is real, then painted rice cakes are real. Therefore, painted rice cakes are the only remedy for satisfying hunger. Now, it's an honor to be asked to address you today, an audience of longtime practitioners and teachers, but I admit I have some trepidation. I remember from my own experience of Western Dharma centers years ago the low opinion that many practitioners used to hold of Buddhist scholars. I once heard a practitioner comment that academia is a hell realm for those who in previous lives thought too much. Now, I honestly don't know how much of this attitude is still prevalent. My guess is it's not quite as strong as it used to be. But in any case, in the 70s, the attitude was really understandable. The politics of the Vietnam War years encouraged a healthy skepticism of institutional authority, of book learning as opposed to practical knowledge, as well as a distrust of hypocrisy, of people who did not live what they preach, or who live it only as an outward performance. So-called Sunday Christians. Do people know the term Sunday Christians? Right, to quote a bluegrass practice, who live like Christians on the Sabbath day, but come Monday morning till the coming Sunday, they will fight their neighbor all along the way. Indeed, the one thing that drew me to Buddhism and Zen was the promise that Buddhist teachers had the wherewithal, the spiritual technology, to personally experience and live the enlightenment that they teach. Unlike Jewish rabbis or Catholic priests, for example, who are just suits working for some large corporation, Buddhism promised a kind of spiritual authenticity. I think that might work, but it might not get to my glasses. Now my eyes are too bad. But thank you. Despite the allure of authenticity, my own spiritual development proved disappointing. I practiced hard, but I was the sort of person who, no matter how much time and energy I put into sitting, and no matter how profound and awesome my moments of insight and transcendence during long retreats, I found myself at the end of the day falling into the same old ruts when I came out, being the same insecure, narcissistic, neurotic jerk that I had been at the beginning. And this bugged me. I was young, and I had a particular notion of what enlightenment was, a transformative experience that would utterly and deeply and permanently alter who I was. After enlightenment, I wouldn't have to work so hard at being nice or selfless or calm or patient or wise. I would simply and effortlessly be all those things. I'm actually curious if you have students today who come to Zen with the same attitude. Now, authenticity, at least the way we commonly think of it, has to do with the relationship between how one presents oneself on the outside and what goes on the inside. It has to do with goals and ideals and how deeply one is committed to not only espousing them, but also to living them. Sunday Christians don't make it. Painted rice cakes don't make it. Now, as Soto teachers, you may find yourself grappling with this. You may have a nagging sense at times that you are faking it. And here I feel for you. One of the things I most appreciate about being an academic is that we aren't assumed to be living embodiments of the traditions that we represent. Right? It's okay for me in front of a classroom to say, this is what the texts say and this is what the tradition says, and leave it at that. Which doesn't mean that academics don't have their own concerns about faking it. They all do. It's just that the stakes don't seem quite so high. As Zen teachers, you might feel that faking it is not enough. You may feel that the obligation of a Buddhist teacher is inherently greater than that of a rabbi, or a Catholic priest, or an Episcopal priest, much less an academic. In the Jewish and Catholic cases, religious teachers are professionals whose authority comes from the institutions they represent, rather than from some inner spiritual awakening. Or at least this is the common idea. Now, of course, some members of the Jewish or Catholic clergy may seem more together and elicit more respect than others. And this respect may, well, enhance the effectiveness of their teaching. But at the end of the day, from the Zen perspective, they might look more like insurance salesmen than saints. You don't lose sleep over the possibility that your State Farm agent may be a drunk who beats his wife. That's his business. The salesman doesn't matter as long as the institution that he represents honors their contractual agreement. Indeed, the Jewish and Catholic teachings emphasize, each in different ways, human limitations. And the spiritual aspirations of rabbis and Catholic priests might look at first glance a little banal compared to those who take vows to become Buddhas and save all sentient beings. Religions that depend on charismatic authority, such as some strands of evangelical Christianity, are arguably different than the Jewish and Catholic cases. With some evangelicals, the authority of the teacher lies, at least in part, on his or her personal experience of God, or being reborn, or the descent of the Holy Ghost. And in the evangelical movement, there are fewer institutional mechanisms for authorizing clergy, which means that the onus of the individual teacher is on his or her entrepreneurial skills and their ability to attract a following. And for a while, Zen in America seemed to be going the charismatic and entrepreneurial route. And I frankly do not know where it's at anymore. But having rejected religious institutions as moribund, Americans expected their Dharma teachers to not just know about Buddhism, but to be enlightened masters. And as teachers, you may find yourself entangled and perhaps even confused by the expectations and projections of your students. What exactly are those expectations? What does it mean to be a Zen teacher, or a master, or a Buddha? What's enlightenment? Now, I know that according to some, you're not supposed to think about this stuff, much less argue about it. Enlightenment and Bodhi and Nirvana, these terms denote something that lies beyond the reach of thought. The only way to know it is to be it, to experience it directly. But one thing I want to suggest today is this was not the prevailing point of view among Buddhist and Zen teachers in the past, many of whom spent a tremendous amount of time and energy discussing and debating precisely these issues, including Dogen, of course, who never shied away from an argument, who castigated virtually all of the great masters of China, and who, I would note on the side, placed a premium not on experience, but on the authority of scripture and the imprimatur of institutional sanction. Now, in our earliest surviving Buddhist texts, here I'm thinking of the Pali Suttas and the Agamas, nirvana, the term nirvana seems pretty straightforward. Nirvana, which literally means to blow out, refers to the permanent cessations and defilements, at the end of rebirth. There are two kinds. People know about the two kinds of nirvana, with remainder and without remainder. So the nirvana without, I'm skipping a little bit since you know that, it refers to the final death of the Buddha, from which there is no further birth. And the Buddha or Arhat is finished, right? They're kaput. Indeed, the problem is that in many texts, nirvana looks an awful lot like the way death looks to someone who doesn't believe in the afterlife. It looks like simple insentience. Now, since the Buddhists did not believe that nirvana was some sort of eternal blissful state, or they're not supposed to believe that, they were accused of being nihilists. And this is very common. If you read the Pali Suttas, you see that they're accused of this all the time. And the radical notion of nirvana as utter cessation, given the mores of the time, seemed very austere or grim or stoic. And the Buddhists came up with a response. And in the process, they began to somewhat equivocate on the eternal absence of the Buddha. Nirvana, they began to argue, only looks like cessation to the unenlightened. In truth, it's beyond thought and comprehension. And the existence of the Tathagata after death is a question that the Buddha famously refused to answer. It's four of the 14 questions that the Buddha refused to talk about. Now, the notion that nirvana is not simple cessation or insentience was not an easy argument to make, given what is found in the early scriptures and the logic of the Buddhist analysis of mind on causation. It looks pretty straightforward that at a certain point, very early on, it was simple cessation. So to argue that it was not insentience, they needed to have another state, another attainment, that they could contrast it to. And they found it in the notion of Nirodha Samapatti. Do people know about Nirodha Samapatti? I will talk about it a bit. The term Nirodha is another term that means cessation. It's a very old concept. Probably predates the Buddha. And it seems to have been really central to the shamanic and yogic traditions out of which the Buddha came. We find it in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, for example, where Nirodha refers to the cessation of the defilements, very much like nirvana, except that in the Yoga Sutras, what this leads to is the understanding that you are the Absolute. So, in the Buddha's own search for nirvana, he mastered the various yogic techniques under his day, under two very famous masters, Arada Kalama and Uddaraka Ramaputra. And in the developed Buddhist system, there are eight jhanas, or trances. And according to the later biographical tradition, Siddhartha mastered the first seven under his first teacher, and then the eighth under the second teacher. The eighth being the neither perception nor non-perception. And the Buddhist tradition is very clear that these advanced states of shamatha, or trance, are useful but not essential to the Buddhist path. Now, if you go back to the early Agamas, or the early Pali Suttas, the term Nirodha is used more or less synonymously with nirvana. They're just two terms for the extinction of the defilements. But as the tradition develops, Nirodha comes to refer to something else. It refers to a new ninth jhana, right, which is added to the other eighth. This is Nirodha Samapatti, or the higher attainment of cessation. And it's marked by the cessation of all conscious activity. The only thing that distinguishes this insentient state from death, in fact, is that the body retains something that Buddhaghosa calls heat, or vitality. In other words, you don't die. The body keeps going, but the mind has completely stopped. So at this point, Buddhist scholiasts could say, look, you think nirvana is cessation. That's not it. Nirodha is cessation, right? Nirvana is something different than that. Now, I'm sorry, I couldn't help but go into some of the fun parts about Nirodha, because as soon as you have this state, you have all sorts of conceptual puzzles. If all conscious activity ceases in Nirodha, how do you ever come out of it? You can't will yourself out of it. Moreover, what happens if someone dies in Nirodha? Right? You can't be reborn, since the chain of karmic conditioning has been suspended. But they can't enter nirvana either, since by definition, Nirodha is not nirvana. And Nirodha is something that it's part of the shamatha tradition, rather than the insight tradition. So they came up with lots of solutions. One, only arhats and anagamis, right, non-returners, can attain Nirodha. And this eliminates the problem of what happens to a monk who dies in Nirodha, because at that point it's fine if they become nirvanized. But another solution is actually my favorite, is that the body of a monk in Nirodha is indestructible. And there's a wonderful story about a monk who goes into Nirodha for 7 days. Typically, they would go in for 7 days. And then the monastery catches on fire, it all burns down, and he's just sitting there and kind of wakes up after 7 days and discovers what happens. So this gets around the problem of what happens if you die in Nirodha, because you can't die in Nirodha, because otherwise you would enter nirvana, because there's no chain of karmic conditioning. Then to the first question, how do you ever get out of Nirodha, the answer is, they say, you take a vow. And the vow is actually somehow held in the Bhavanga Chitta, this particular consciousness that resides in the body. It's not a very satisfactory answer to it, but it seemed to have worked for a while. Now, this may all seem like the product of scholastic monks with much too much time on their hands. But what I want to suggest is that there's actually a serious existential issue here. And that is the goal of practice at the end of the day to become insentient, so utterly detached from the world around one that one is spiritually or ethically no different from a rock or a tree or a table? Early Buddhism was, after all, an ascetic tradition that involves abandoning everything that you hold most dear, parents and spouse and children. The goal is utter dispassion, accomplished with the help of an awful lot of pain, the contemplation of rotting corpses, and all sorts of other privations. The Visuddhimagga is clear. Nirvana comes to one who is utterly inured to suffering and death. No wonder the Buddhists felt the need to defend themselves against the charge of nihilism. Now, this may seem really far from Zen. And indeed, the notion of Nirvana did not excite the imaginations of the Chinese the way it did the Indians. This is probably because the Mahayanists in China were less invested in Abhidharma categories and in Indian theories of causation. And a lot of this debate was invisible to the Chinese because they actually used the same term sometimes to translate both Nirvana and Nirvana. There's a lot of just confusion about this. However, in 8th century China, there was a very acrimonious debate among the leading Zen masters of the day over whether insentient objects such as grass and trees, stones and roof tiles could attain Buddhahood and preach the Dharma. And I think the same set of existential and ethical issues were actually at stake. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this debate. But the roots of it actually go back to the 5th century and a debate over whether all beings possess Buddha nature or whether there's a special class of beings known as Icchantika who are without Buddha nature. Has anybody heard of this one?
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, the Hoso school, which I was ordained in, they were the only ones who believed that there are Icchantika who live around the Buddha nature, and they still debate this point today. The position that won the day, which you all know, is that all beings have Buddha nature. But all beings mean sentient beings and not things like grass and stones and trees and rooftops. That's what it says in the Nirvana Sutra. But a century or so later, some Zen masters began to argue that there is a sense in which even insentient objects have Buddha nature. Now, the earliest versions of this, they're by monks Jingyin Huiyuan, for example, or the Madhyamika master Jizang, they claimed that all things, sentient and non-sentient, must possess Buddha nature. Basically, they were specialists in Madhyamika, or emptiness theory, and they said you can't make a distinction between sentient and insentient. However, they said only sentient beings can realize it. Right? Jizang says, because sentient beings have delusions, they can attain awakening. Grass and trees have no mind, mushin, right? And thus they have no delusion. What would it mean for them to obtain awakening? It's like waking from a dream. If you're not dreaming, then you can't wake up from it. End quote. But later figures, such as the Tendai patriarch Jianran, go farther. And they claim that insentient objects such as walls and roof tiles not only have Buddha nature, but realize awakening and preach the Dharma. And this eventually became the consensus position, especially in Japan, and you're all, I'm sure, familiar with Dogen's writings on the topic. And that Dogen is coming in part from the Tendai tradition. But the consensus did not come easily. And some early Zen masters vigorously resisted this. And while it's often thought to be a rather sterile and abstract debate among scholar monks, it was anything but. Virtually all of the founding fathers of the Zen movement were directly and passionately involved in this debate. We know this from a bunch of texts that were discovered at Dunhuang. And these texts, some of the earliest ones, depict the 4th patriarch and the 5th patriarch as advocates of the Buddha nature of the insentient position. And they argue it by invoking a meditative experience wherein the distinction between the outer material realm and the inner experiential realm disappears. And their writings resonate with a lot of later Sotozi teachers, including Suzuki Roshi. I'll give you an example. Quote, Hongren said, the Buddha has 32 marks. Don't jars also have the 32 marks? Don't pillars also have the 32 marks? Proceeding in the same way, earth, trees, tiles, and stones, don't they have the 32 marks? He also said, at the moment when you're sitting in meditation in the temple, is your body also sitting in meditation between the trees of the mountain forests? Are earth, trees, tiles, and stones, aren't they also able to sit in meditation? And so on. Get the flavor. And in their discussion of the Buddha nature of insentient objects, Daoxin and Hongren, that's the fourth and fifth patriarch in the Chinese lineage, they refer to the non-duality of the subjective and objective realms, as well as the doctrine associated with the Lankavatara that everything is mind. And if everything is mind, then you can't make a distinction between sentient and insentient. And one of my favorite examples of this is from a text called The Treatise on the Transcendence of Cognition, or the Transcendence of Thought. I'll just read a little section. The student asks, is the way found only in embodied spiritual entities, or does it reside in grass and trees as well? The master said, there is no place the way does not reside. The student said, if the way is everywhere, why is it a crime to kill a person, but it's not a crime to kill grass and trees? And the teacher said, well, when you talk about whether it's a crime or not, that's related to sentience, and thus is not the true way. It is only because unenlightened people have not attained the way and falsely believe in a self that their murder entails intent. This intent bears fruit, and thus we speak of it as a crime. Grass and trees have no sentience, and therefore are in perfect accord with the way. As they're free of a self, there is no karma involved in killing them, and thus we don't argue whether it is a crime or not. Now, if you're free of a self and in accord with the way, you look at your own body as you would grass or trees. You would treat the cutting of your own body as you do trees in a forest. Now, this is a very powerful statement about Mushin, right? What it means to be no mind. And there's a real sense of there really is no distinction with the insentient there. In other words, it's precisely because they lack mind and sentience and have no thought of me or mine that grass and trees are one with the way. So the way to Buddhahood is the way of insentience. You must put an end to cognition and become mindless. Then, like grass and trees, you will be one with the way and utterly unconcerned with death. Now, the Dunhuang documents suggest that this position was common among Zen masters that we now associate with the Northern School, including Huineng's rival, Xianxiu. Indeed, a few of these teachers promoted the more radical version of the doctrine in which all insentient objects actually cultivate realization and become Buddhas. But not all of the early Zen patriarchs agreed. And some of the prominent figures thought that the Buddha nature of the insentient position was stupid. And one of the most strident critiques is found in the record of Hutz's Shenhui. Shenhui is the one whose scholars now realize was behind the Platform Sutra. He was the one who really, if he didn't create, he certainly shaped the myth of Huineng, and had a lot to do with the writing of the Platform Sutra. And he's one of these people who's really against this doctrine. And there's a record again from Dunhuang of him debating a master from the Oxed school. The Oxed school was one of the northern schools most associated with Madhyamika. So the Zen master Yuan, he's this Oxed master, said, you say that Buddha nature permeates all sentient beings, but not insentient things. But I heard a venerable elder say, lush groves of emerald bamboo are wholly the Dharma body. Luxurious clusters of chrysanthemums, nothing is not prajna, nothing is not wisdom. Now, why do you say that Buddha nature only permeates sentient things and not insentient things? And Shenhui answered, surely you don't mean that the merit of groves of bamboo equals the Dharma body, or that the wisdom of clusters of chrysanthemums is the same as prajna. In which sutra does the Tathagata record a single case of a bamboo or a chrysanthemum attaining Bodhi? The notion that bamboo and chrysanthemum are the same as the Dharma body and wisdom is a heterodox doctrine. And he goes on to cite the Nirvana Sutra as evidence for this. Now it seems, there's a long story here, but in brief, Shenhui and his followers flagged this doctrine as a way to distinguish themselves from the Northern School. Recall that, according to these early Dunhuang documents, the fourth and fifth patriarchs, and the fifth one is Hong Ren's own teacher, is actually a proponent of the Buddha nature of the insentient. But now look at the Platform Sutra. Here, Hong Ren is turned into an opponent of the doctrine. In the transmission verse in the Platform Sutra goes as follows. You probably never noticed that it had to do with the Buddha nature of insentient objects. It says, sentient beings come and lay down seeds. From the earth, fruit is produced. Without sentiency and without seeds, there is no Buddha nature and nothing is produced. That's the transmission verse from the Platform Sutra. Now, these verses are one of the most, they really capture one of the most important moments in the early transmission narrative. Moreover, a transmission verse was the very essence of a master's wisdom, as well as his distinctive teaching style. So what are we to make of the fact that the core of Hong Ren's transmission is a critique of the Buddha nature of insentient objects? Shenhui evidently viewed this as a wedge issue through which they could really begin to distinguish themselves from their rivals. I've got other quotes here on this one. I'm going to kind of skip a little bit. I have a long section here on what this has to do with Joshu's dog. I'm going to put that aside for now. We can come back in the discussion if anybody wants it. You want to go right? Okay.
Actually, Robert, you talk about Buddha nature over and over again. Maybe you could say what Buddha nature is so we'll know whether it has or hasn't.
Okay. What the Nirvana Sutra says is, where it goes back to the issue over Ichantika, is Buddha nature refers, it's a very simple notion originally. Where this goes is rather complicated, but initially it means you have the potential to become a Buddha yourself. It is central to Mahayana, and it's a way of separating Mahayanists from Hinayanists. So those who have the potential to become Buddhas have Buddha nature. Now I know this will sound like evasive, I'm just giving, this is what the text said.
The next question, of course, what's a Buddha? So, because the whole argument you're making is predicated on this son of the bay, I think it's helpful to really look at the very core issue here.
You know what, I think I appreciate what you're asking, but I think I'll be in a better position after I finish this. Because part of it has to do with what are we to make, not the detail, not what did they mean, but the very fact that they're debating over this is really what's important to me. The fact, you're asking me for clarity on an issue where part of my argument is there was no clarity in these texts. We expect ourselves to have clarity on something that the tradition did not seem to be able to hammer out. These were very fraught debates. So in a way, just let me continue a little bit. So I'll get into, since this is a bit of an excursus into Jiaozhou's dog, but I just want to mention that this debate was the context for Joshu's move. And the full exchange, if you want where that exchange come from, look in the Jiaozhou Yulu, or Joshu's recorded sayings, we find the following exchange. A student asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And the master said, does not. And by the way, that's what the Chinese text says. So, no. And the student says, but everything from the Buddhas above to the ants below has Buddha nature. Why does a dog not have it? And the master said, because he has the nature of karmically conditioned consciousness. So it might not be clear that that has anything to do with the Buddha nature of the insentient, but here, look at this other exchange that's found in the text. So the student asks, does an oak tree have Buddha nature or not? The master said, it has. This is Joshu. And the student says, then when will it become a Buddha? And the master said, when the sky falls to the earth. And the student said, when will the sky fall to the earth? And the master said, when the oak tree becomes a Buddha. Now finally note a third exchange, again in the same text. A student asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And the master said, the road in front of every house leads to Chang'an. That was exactly the same statement as all roads lead to Rome. And it was quite clearly a statement that, of course, right, all beings become Buddhas. Now, Joshu's response to the second question about oak trees suggests that he will accept, at least provisionally, the Buddha nature of the insentient, such as things like trees. And in the third exchange, he has no trouble conceiving Buddha nature to dogs. So why does he deny it the first time around? And why does everybody get so excited about that part? So the first questioner is completely aware that according to Buddhist teachings, all sentient life has Buddha nature. No educated cleric in the Tang would mistake the interlocutor's question as an expression of ignorance. The question only makes sense in the light of the Buddha nature of the insentient debates. It's a challenge to Joshu to articulate his understanding of the controversy in a manner that remains true to Zen principles. Joshu has to respond in a fashion that doesn't express attachment to or reify the distinction between sentient and insentient, or between having and not having Buddha nature. At the same time, he must avoid positing any third medial position, right? Like the position that things neither have nor don't have Buddha nature, or Buddha nature is not a something that you can have or not have, right? Because to do so would merely to create a new conceptual dichotomy, this time between the absolute, where all distinctions are resolved, and the contingent realm of plurality. So Joshu's response, his unapologetic denial of Buddha nature to dogs, denotes his freedom from attachment to doctrine. Right? His acknowledgement that no conventional formulation is ultimate. And at the same time, it denotes his refusal to attempt to articulate a medial or transcendental position. He's doing exactly the same thing that Dogen does with his painted rice cakes. Now, Mumon. So the reason you probably first, or at least you probably first heard of Joshu's Mu in the context of Mumon's collection. And he was familiar with the context. Right? So look at his commentary. Look at Mumon's commentary for the koan. He says, to study Zen, you must pass through the barrier of the patriarchal masters. To gain marvelous enlightenment, you must completely sever the way of mind. If you have not passed through the barrier and not severed the way of mind, you are no more than the spirit that haunts the grasses and the trees. Now, grasses and trees, you just have to take my word for it. This is the key term in the Buddha nature of the insentient debate. So there's a complicated literary move going on here. And I know that this may rub some of you the wrong way, and this is something that a lot of my work has been arguing that these koans initially were a form of exegesis and a way of training monks to engage in debate. Right? Later on it becomes something else, but my argument is when these things were put together by Mumon and Lucrative Record and so on, it was still a lively exegetical discourse. And I've written on this, people want references, I can give you it afterwards, but just in brief, Mumon's reference to the spirits of grasses and trees, he's actually citing Linji here, so there's a lot of textual allusion going on. But it's an allusion to the Buddha nature of the insentient controversy. Like Joshu, Mumon refuses to support either side of the debate, but at the same time, he cannot accept a medial position, right? A position that seems to stand above the debate. Mumon does this through a literary reference that alludes to a sentience abiding in grasses and trees, while the immediate context denies sentient to dogs. Right? In the Nirvana Sutra, anything lacking Buddha nature is insentient. So how does grasses and trees suddenly happen? In other words, Joshu's emphatic insistence that dogs do not have Buddha nature would suppose, make it even less likely that grass and trees have Buddha nature, because they're insentient. But in a twist, Mumon declares that if you don't get what Joshu was doing when he denies Buddha nature to dogs, then you are like the sentience of grass and trees. He's a good guy.
He doesn't say sentience,
though. Spirit. He says spirit. Give me a little bit of poetic leeway. Now, it's interesting that in this heated debate concerning the meaning and nature of Buddhahood itself, that this particular debate played such a central role in the schism, however short-lived, that gave rise to the Southern School of Zen. And the support for the Buddha nature of the insentient by most of the prominent masters of the day presented Shen Hui with a really easy target. From Shen Hui's point of view, the doctrine is more than merely contrary to both scripture and common sense. It is morally pernicious and injurious to the way. And this is because identifying the physical world around us with the world of enlightenment undermines the need for rigorous practice and personal transformation. It's a version of what I call the Alan Watts heresy. The notion that once you understand that samsara and nirvana or self and other or inside or other, outside are one, then there's no longer any need for rigorous practice or study. I started with Dogen. I mean, I'm trying to, you know. Yeah. I'm still, they're Soto teachers. I'm trying to.
You're doing a great job.
So I'd like to suggest that the Chinese discussions concerning the Buddha nature of the insentient objects and the Indian discussions about the relationship between nirvana and niroda were both grappling with a problem that lies at the very heart of Buddhist and Zen teachings. What do we mean by no self? Or cessation, or no mind, or for that matter, hishibyo, right? Not thinking. Some Western Buddhists are confident that mindfulness, or sati, and mindlessness, or mushin, are ultimately one and the same thing. But many eminent Buddhist masters throughout Asian history, including the founding patriarchs of Zen, struggled with this. Is no mind or not thinking, as the Northern School masters state, seem to imply a state of quiet, expansive awareness in which all discursive distinctions drop away? Or, following the Southern School's critique, is this a trap? Something that makes you feel good for a while, but is not the equivalent of real insight? So to return to the issue of Zen authenticity, we can ask, authentic to what? Given the American suspicion of scriptural, institutional, and hierarchical models of authority, a suspicion that is sometimes mistakenly attributed to Zen itself, Americans want their Zen teachers to personally embody Buddhist ideals. Yet these very ideals were the subject of heated discussions and debate among leading Asian masters for some 2,000 years. And even within the Zen school, one looks in vain for any clear consensus. Now, I could take the easy way out, which academics often do, and say that the questions are more important than the answers. But instead, I want to introduce you to what I think is a very powerful theory of religion and ritual put forward by the scholar Jonathan Z. Smith. Smith was reading on Siberian bear hunting rituals, and he began to note a discrepancy between what Siberian bear hunters say they do and what they actually do. According to one set of descriptions, the hunt begins with ceremonies intended to ensure the hunter's success. And this includes divinations and killing effigies of the bear and invocations to the gods of the animals and to the hunter's guardian spirit, purification of the hunters, and so on. Then rituals are conducted to ask the forest for permission to enter. The kill itself is governed by very strict rules of etiquette designed to ensure that, I'm quoting here from Smith, the animal is killed in hand-to-hand and face-to-face combat. For example, in some groups, the bear may be killed only while running toward the hunter, or while the bear is standing on its hind legs facing the hunter. It may never be killed while sleeping or in its den. In addition, it may only be wounded in certain spots. The eye, you're not supposed to poke at the eye, and the wound should not draw blood. To quote from one example, the Yakut say that if one kills a bear in its hibernation den without taking care to awake or warn the bear, other bears will attack the hunter while he sleeps. Now, Smith thought about this and found it all completely ridiculous. He said, would hunters who have wives and kids to take care of really put themselves in such an unnecessary risk every time they went off to kill a bear? Would they really wait for the bear to assume a certain posture and then begin reciting ceremonial verses to it? So he looked more closely. finding anthropological accounts of real hunts, not what the bear hunters say they do, but what they actually do. And not surprisingly, he found something surprisingly different. Siberian hunters make regular use of traps, pits, snares, and more recently, guns. Anything that would allow them to keep a safe distance from an angry bear. If they have to encounter a bear, they consider it best to trap it in its den, cut a hole in the roof, and stab it or shoot it to death before it can break out. Dogs are used to injure or exhaust the bear. The Nivki, for example, say, quote, in order not to excite the bear's posthumous revenge, do not surprise him, but have a fair stand-up fight, end quote. But in fact, they like to ambush the bear. They hide a spear in the ground covered with spikes, and as the bear approaches, the spear is raised by a cord so as to impale the poor beast. Smith notes that those who hunt bears as a way of life have no illusions about the dangers involved and would not be so stupid to risk their lives unnecessarily. Now, Smith, and this is where he gets some traction here, he says the gap between what they say they do and what they do is not hypocrisy. Bear hunters are perfectly aware of the discrepancy, and they work with it. And the venue, the way that they work with it, is through ritual. Many Siberian hunting communities celebrate a bear festival in which a bear is ritually slain. And I'm quoting now from his account. A young wild bear cub is taken alive, brought to a village, and caged. It is treated as an honored guest, with high courtesy, displays of affection, at times being adopted by a human family. After 2 or 3 years, a festival is held. The bear is roped and taken on a farewell walk through the village. It's made to dance and play and walk on its hind legs. Then it is carefully tied down in a given position and ceremonially addressed. It is slain, usually being shot at the heart, through the heart at close range, and sometimes afterwards it is strangled. The body is then divided and eaten with ceremonial etiquette. Its soul is enjoined to return to its owner and report on how well it has been treated. So the suggestion is that the bear festival represents the perfect hunt, the ideal hunt, based on a notion of reciprocity that could never be achieved in a real hunt since bears don't cooperate. In the ritual hunt, all of the variables are controlled. The animal is compelled to play its part, it's treated correctly as a guest, it's constrained to rejoice in its fate, and to walk to its death rather than run away. To assume the correct posture for its slaughter, to have the proper words addressed to it, and before it is killed, to be slain face to face. So ritual then represents the creation of a controlled environment, unaffected by the messy but unavoidable contingencies of ordinary life. It is, and I'm quoting Smith now, a way of performing the way things ought to be, in conscious tension to the way things are, in such a way that this ritualized perfection is recollected in ordinary, uncontrolled daily life. Now, from this perspective, the notion that the Sunday Christian is somehow hypocritical or insincere or inauthentic misses the point. If Christians behave during the week the way they behave on Sundays, then there would be no need for Sundays or church or for Christianity. I think, right? Only painted rice cakes satisfy hunger. And ritual separates things out. It marks them as special. Precisely so to kind of underscore the gap between the way we would like things to be if we had real control over the situation and the way things really are. So what about Zen? We know the ideal. Zen, we're told, at least I was told, I don't know what you tell your students, is not supposed to be about monasteries and robes and bells and chantings and roshis and incense and ritual. Right? Real Zen is practiced in the midst of daily life. The ability to stay present, to stay awake, to give expression to our Buddha natures, to be without greed, anger, and delusion, in short, to be compassionate bodhisattvas in the midst of contingencies. This is real Zen. And that's why some go so far as to claim that Zen is not religion. But Zen is also all about setting things apart, marking things as non-ordinary. Priests wear their attire that is not only marked as special, but the notes, particularly in Japan, I don't know if you do it, your very specific position in a very complex hierarchy. Practitioners follow prescribed schedules, there's gongs and bells and locks. Not only is your physical posture prescribed, but even the focus of your mental attention. The ritualization of body, speech, and mind extends to every aspect of Zen life, or at least temple life, meals, bathing, going to the toilet, sleeping. I cannot think of any other Buddhist school that so obsessively attempts to control each moment of waking life. So you might respond, well, this is just an expedient. This is just upaya. It's a means toward an end. To mistake the outer ritual form for real Zen is to mistake the finger for the moon. Over time, you're supposed to close the gap between the enlightened self that you construct in the domain of the monastery, this very tightly controlled domain, and the self-centered narcissist that returns once the props have been removed. In other words, you leave the painted rice cake behind as you attain the real thing. But maybe the gap between the enactment of enlightened activity in the Zendo and the chaotic and confused mess of daily life is precisely the point. If you confuse the two, you end up faking it. And I submit, taking a bit of a risk, that this was understood by Buddhist masters of the past, just as it is understood by Jewish and Catholic clergy today. Which brings us back to Dogen's painted rice cakes. Painted rice cakes are the only remedy for satisfying hunger. Now, religion has a pretty bad rap these days, and to suggest that Soto Zen is a religion may strike some of you as misguided or simplistic or clueless, or the kind of things that academics say. But I offer this, I hope, in the spirit of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, or Madhyamika, which are, after all, critical and subversive traditions that are try to undermine everything you think you know about Buddhism. Right? The Zen teachings transpose these Indian teachings into a very playful kind of idiom. Genzai's If You Meet the Buddha, Kill the Buddha, Mumon, it's my favorite actually, called Shakyamuni, a swindler who offers us dog meat and calls it mutton. So to insist that Zen alone is exempt from the force of its own critique, that Zen is the moon toward which other religions merely point, that Zen is the real rice cake where all the others are painted, that's where I think you begin to enter the realm of hubris, and there's a real risk of faking it. Thank you.